A Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious, Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. Welcome to the Deep Dive.
Today, we're doing something a bit different. We're not just opening a history book. We're diving headfirst into, well, a roaring fire, a kind of cosmic drama, really.
That's right, as seen through the explosive writings of Thomas Carlyle.
Exactly. Our mission, to unpack his really quite dramatic and moral interpretation of the French Revolution, a history.
And figure out what it means for us.
Yes, what profound, sometimes unsettling lessons it might hold for us today.
It's a big one. Because, you know, Carlyle's work isn't your typical history.
Mm-hmm.
Not at all.
How so?
It's more like a philosophical epic, a really passionate declaration that views the French Revolution not just as, you know, politics and dates.
Right.
But as this sweeping, almost divine judgment against a corrupt, insincere society. He wants us to get the fundamental why. Mm-hmm. Why societies collapse, why they transform. It goes way beyond just the what happened. Okay, that's fascinating. So a historical narrative, a moral meditation, and a literary masterpiece all rolled into one. What makes Carlyle's take so distinct?
Well, Thomas Carlyle himself, he was this titan of Victorian thought, lived 1795 to 1881, and his background is key.
Yeah,
he had this bedrock of a strict Scottish Calvinist morality, so a very strong sense of right and wrong, you know, an eye for hypocrisy.
Okay, that makes sense.
Then he got really deep into German romantic philosophy, thinkers like Goethe, German idealism, stuff exploring the mind's power, history as this grand unfolding.
So less about just facts, more about deeper forces.
Exactly. It gave him this almost prophetic kind of biblical lens on history. He saw it as a moral drama.
And he's famous for his great man theory, isn't he? That history is shaped by exceptional individuals.
He is, yes. That's definitely part of his thinking. But what's interesting here, and maybe a bit surprising, is that this book also puts this incredible focus on the elemental power of the masses. The ordinary people, the urban poor.
The sans-culottes, as he calls them.
Precisely. He shows that history isn't just kings and generals. It's also this collective fury of an oppressed people rising up.
So what made him the guy to write this?
Well, two things, really. First, incredibly rigorous research. He spent years buried in the British Museum, digging through French primary sources, pamphlets, memoirs, the real stuff.
Okay, so he did his homework.
Oh, absolutely. But then he combined that scholarly depth with this just astonishing dramatic power. He didn't just report history. He almost like performed it on the page.
I mean,
his style, people call it Carlyle-ese. It's just electric, full of energy and metaphors. It pulls you right in. It feels almost cinematic, you know, like you're there in the streets of Paris.
Wow. And isn't there that famous story about the first volume? The manuscript?
Oh, yes. The story is legendary, and it tells you so much about his dedication.
Go on.
So he finishes the first volume, right? Lends the manuscript to his friend, the philosopher John Stuart Mill.
That's right.
And Mill's maid accidentally burns it, thinks it's waste paper, and tosses it in the fire.
No. Oh, my God.
Can you imagine? Your life's work just gone.
I can't even. That's utterly devastating.
But here's the thing. Carlyle, apparently from memory and maybe a few rough notes, painstakingly rewrote the entire volume.
From memory, the whole thing.
That's the story. It's almost like the process mirrored the subject, you know? Destruction, chaos, followed by this furious act of recreation.
That level of dedication, it almost gives him a unique kind of authority, doesn't it?
I think it does. And maybe that personal trial, that fire, infused the final work with even more intensity. He understood loss and rebirth on a really visceral level.
Okay, so let's talk about the book itself. The French Revolution.
A history. It's not just a chronicle, then.
Not at all. It's Carlyle's grand attempt to capture the full scope and, crucially, the meaning of the event.
Meaning in what sense?
In a moral and spiritual sense, more than just political or economic.
Right.
His central argument, his big idea, is that the revolution wasn't just an accident of politics. It was inevitable. Maybe even divinely ordained in a way.
Divine judgment, sort of. He saw it as this explosion of popular rage, a cosmic payback for centuries of oppression, injustice, and moral rot in the old system, the Ancien Regime.
So the old aristocratic order.
Exactly. It was a purgative fire burning away what he called the shams, the hollow institutions, the fake authorities, the lies society lived by. It was a brutal return to, well, reality.
And the book takes us through the whole thing.
Oh, yeah. It's a vast journey. From the dying days of Louis VI's decadent court through the initial hope, then the radicalization, the bloody terror.
And finishing with Napoleon.
Right up to the rise of Napoleon Bonaparte.
And his goal wasn't just to tell the story.
No, his purpose, his goal was to show how and why societies like that collapse, why established orders fall apart. It's a massive cautionary tale.
About what happens when injustice festers.
Precisely. When the people in charge ignore deep-seated problems, when the system becomes morally bankrupt, well, Carlyle shows the terrible cost, the explosion that can follow.
Okay, let's dive into that story then. He breaks down into three volumes, right?
Yes, three powerful volumes, each tackling a distinct phase. It really helps structure the chaos.
So volume one, The Bastille, covering 1774 to 1789. Where does he start?
He starts with the decay. The death of Louis XV is kind of symbolic of this corrupt, cynical monarchy, totally out of touch.
And Louis VI and Marie Antoinette.
He portrays them as, well, maybe well-meaning, but completely ineffective. Inheriting, as he puts it, an impossible situation. The kingdom was just rotten underneath.
And he calls this the age of paper. What does that mean?
It refers to the financial chaos. The kingdom was basically bankrupt, running on paper money and dodgy schemes, while the tax system was grossly unfair. Nobles and clergy paid hardly anything.
Right. The burden fell on the poor.
Exactly. And things like the diamond necklace affair, this crazy scandal involving a cardinal, a prostitute impersonating the queen, and a massively expensive necklace.
I've heard of that.
For Carlyle, it wasn't just gossip. It showed the moral rot, the utter disconnect, the sham right at the heart of the court.
So the foundations were crumbling.
Completely. And summoning the Estates General in 1789, the old representative body that was the spark.
Why? Because it gave the commoners a voice.
Precisely. The Third Estate, everyone who wasn't clergy or nobility, they just took over, declared themselves the National Assembly, made that defiant tennis court oath, vowing not to disband until France had a constitution. For Carlyle, that was the real start, the assertion of will.
Which leads us to the Bastille, July 14th, 1789.
Yes. And Carlyle depicts this not just as, you know, seizing an old prison. It's the moment. Cosmic. Symbolic.
How so?
It's the raw elemental fury of the people finally breaking through, shattering the old world, the old symbols of oppression. It's less a military strategy, more this primal act that changes everything. His insight is that sometimes real change needs that kind of symbolic shattering.
Okay, so that's volume one. Then volume two, The Constitution, takes us from 1789 to 1792. Things seem hopeful at first.
Yeah, there's this initial phase, abolishing feudalism, the Declaration of the Rights of Man. There's even this big festival in 1790, the Fête de la Fédération, a moment of kind of fragile unity.
Fragile being the key word.
Definitely fragile. Because underneath, things are getting more extreme. Political clubs are popping up everywhere.
And we meet the key players.
Yes, Carlyle brings them vividly to life. The eloquent, but maybe compromised Mirabeau, the fiery, passionate Danton, the radical journalist Marat stirring things up, and the cold, dogmatic Robespierre.
The sea green incorruptible.
That's Carlyle's famous phrase for him. And you see moderation starting to lose ground to these more extreme voices. Trust is breaking down fast.
And what pushes it over the edge, according to Carlyle?
The big turning point in this volume is the flight to Varennes in June 1791.
The king and queen try to escape.
Yeah, the royal family makes a run for it, trying to get out of France. They get caught near the border. For Carlyle, this was disastrous.
Why specifically?
Because it proved their insincerity, as he'd put it. It shattered any remaining public trust in the king, the idea of a constitutional monarchy, basically dead after that. It just empowered the hardline Republicans who wanted to get rid of the monarchy altogether.
Which leads us straight into the really dark stuff. Volume 3, The Guillotine, 1792 to 1795.
Yeah, this is where Carlyle plunges us into the vortex of the revolution consuming itself.
How does it start?
It kicks off with the horrific September massacres in 1792. Parisian mobs, fueled by fear and paranoia, drag prisoners, priests, nobles, political suspects out of jails and just butcher them. Thousands killed. It's pure, uncontrolled bloodshed. Anarchy.
Grim. And then the king's execution.
Louis XVI is put on trial, condemned and executed in January 1793. Carlyle sees this as this incredibly tragic point of no return. France cutting itself off from its entire past. It opens the door to, well, the terror.
The Reign of Terror, yeah. 1793 to 94, under Robespierre.
Right. Carlyle shows this as both the kind of logical endpoint of revolutionary ideology pushed to its extreme, and also its ultimate self-destruction. It becomes this paranoid machine. Even revolutionary leaders like Danton, the Fiery Order, end up on the guillotine.
And Robespierre tries to create his own religion.
Yeah, the bizarre cult of the supreme being, trying to replace Catholicism with this abstract deist thing. For Carlyle, it's another kind of formula, ironically hollow, even in a revolution supposedly about reality.
How does the terror end?
It eats itself. Eventually, the revolutionaries turn on Robespierre himself. He's overthrown and executed in July 1794. That's known as Thermidor.
But is that the end of the revolution for Carlyle?
Not quite the end of the story, but maybe the end of its chaotic, popular phase. The real turning point for him comes a bit later, in Vendémiaire, October 1795.
What happens then?
There's a royalist uprising in Paris trying to restore the monarchy, and this young artillery officer, Napoleon Bonaparte, is called in. He disperses the mob with cannon fire. Carlyle's famous phrase is a whiff of grape shot.
A whiff of grape shot?
Yeah. And for Carlyle, this is hugely significant. The elemental force of the mob, the sans-culottes, which drove the revolution, is finally crushed, tamed by the decisive will of one individual, a great man.
Wow. Okay, so we've gone through the narrative. But Carlyle's not just telling a story, is he? He's driving home some big ideas, some themes.
Absolutely, that's the whole point for him. Mm. Beyond the blood and chaos, there are these powerful, timeless messages.
What's the central one?
Number one has to be sincerity versus sham. Or reality versus formula. This is the moral axis the whole book turns on.
Explain that a bit more.
The ancient regime, the old order, was built on lies, hollow rituals, unjust privileges. It was a massive sham, totally insincere. The revolution, for all its horror, was a violent return to sincerity, to reality.
So a warning.
The huge warning. Any society, any institution built on pretense, on formulas that don't match reality or justice, it's doomed. It will collapse eventually.
Right. What else?
Then there's the idea of historical justice, maybe even divine judgment. He doesn't see these events as just political maneuvering. There's a sense of cosmic inevitability, retribution for centuries of built-up sin and decay, unnecessary, if awful, purgation.
Like history itself has a moral force.
Kind of, yeah. And linked to that is the elemental power of the masses, sans-culottism. The ordinary people aren't just pawns. They become this almost primeval force of nature when pushed too far. Driven by hunger, instinct, righteous anger, they become the instrument of destruction.
But he's not romanticizing the violence, is he?
Not at all. That's another key theme. The tragic nature of revolutionary violence and the danger of abstract ideology. Once you unleash that kind of violence, it spirals out of control. And ideals, like Robespierre's virtue, when they become rigid dogmas, they lead straight to tyranny and mass murder. Abstract theories can be deadly.
So it's necessary, but also horrific.
Exactly. And finally, there's the theme of order arising from chaos, often via a great man. The corrupt old order dissolves into chaos. But out of that chaos, a new, often stronger order emerges. And Carlyle suggests it often takes a figure like Napoleon, a hero with immense will, to finally tame that revolutionary energy and forge something new.
That really makes you think, how do we spot these shams in our own time before things reach that kind of breaking point?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Carlyle's writing itself is just so memorable, too. Even if it's dense sometimes, these phrases just stick with you.
Oh, absolutely. He had a gift for the killer phrase, the image that cuts right through.
Like that central idea, sham is sham and must go.
Exactly. That sums up so much of his argument. Falsehood, corruption, it's unsustainable. It has to be swept away for anything real to emerge.
Or his description of Robespierre, the sea green, incorruptible.
Yeah, it's brilliant, isn't it? It captures that chilling mix of moral purity and absolute inhuman coldness. It helps you understand how an idealist becomes a terrorist.
And that line about the revolution itself.
The revolution is a truth clad in hellfire. That really gets at his complex view. Right. There's a necessary truth, the destruction of lies, but it comes wrapped in the horrors of hellfire. It's not a simple endorsement.
And Napoleon ending the popular phase.
The thing we specifically call French Revolution is blown into space by a whiff of grape shot. So blunt, so decisive. The chaotic energy dispersed by focused force, it's pure Carlyle.
So, taking all this in, how does it apply today? Why should we care about Carlyle's take on an event over 200 years ago?
Well, I think his framework for understanding social revolution is still incredibly relevant. It helps you recognize potential warning signs.
Like what?
Like when institutions lose public trust, when inequality reaches extreme levels, when leaders seem completely disconnected from the lives of ordinary people, Carlyle basically screams at us, pay attention. These are the conditions where things can unravel violently.
So it's a case for reform.
A powerful case for sincere, gradual reform to prevent catastrophic upheaval. Don't let the shams fester.
And what about leadership?
Huge lessons there. Look at the contrast. Louis VI's paralysis versus Robespierre's rigid, deadly ideology. It shows the need for leaders with moral conviction, yes, but also with pragmatism, flexibility, empathy.
It makes you wonder, doesn't it? Are we listening to the pragmatic voices, the Dantons, or are we getting seduced by the purists, the Robespierres, who value theory over people?
It's a critical question. And then there's the personal angle. Carlyle's focus on sincerity versus sham. It's a challenge to us individually to ask ourselves, are we living authentically? Are our beliefs genuine? Or are we just following societal formulas, playing roles? There's a kind of personal integrity he champions.
And finally, the link between justice and stability.
Absolutely crucial. Carlyle's message is stark. Ignore deep social injustices at your peril. It's not just morally wrong, it's politically dangerous. Public trust is fragile. And once it's gone, well, you see what can happen.
You know, reflecting on all this, what really struck me personally was that relentless focus on sincerity. The sham must go idea. It kind of forces you to look at the little formulas and maybe insincerities in your own life, the ways we just go along with things instead of confronting reality.
It's challenging. Yeah. For me, the biggest takeaway is that stark warning about belief. Societies aren't just economics or politics. They're built on shared beliefs, on trust. When that foundation crumbles, when people stop believing in the sham, the whole thing can collapse with terrifying speed and violence. Reality, Carlyle reminds us, will assert itself eventually. No matter how much we try to paper over it with comfortable lies, it's pretty sobering stuff.
What stands out to you from this deep dive into Thomas Carlyle's epic account of the French Revolution? Something to ponder, perhaps, about the forces shaping our own world and the shams that may still need to go. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.